Good evening, and thank you for joining us. Tonight, it will be my pleasure to introduce three women who will each, in their own way, share their thoughts about our nation's involvement in Iraq. This event is sponsored by the Charlottesville Center for Peace and Justice. My name is Sean McCord, and as I look out at this great gathering, I can sense that many of you share the same thought. Who? I'll tell you a little bit more about me in a moment. But first, I want to talk about us. We are Republicans. We are Democrats. We are libertarians, independents, free thinkers, communists, socialists, hippies, yippies, yuppies. We are Christians, Muslim, Jewish, Buddhist, and atheist. We are married, single, dating, and engaged. We are heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, and transsexual. We are white, black, brown, pink, deep thinkers, odd fellows, and fellow travelers. We launched the United Nations and ushered in an unparalleled economic juggernaut that lasted decades. We walked on the moon. We watched in horror as two planes slammed into twin towers, and we donned our gear and we ran inside to carry out the wounded. We packed up food and clothes and helped our neighbors in Louisiana. We hang our flag with pride. We pledge allegiance to our Constitution. And we sing our national anthem in English, in Spanish, in Creole, and Klingon. We are Americans. We are a good people. We are one grand, passionate, often dysfunctional family. And like any family, we have our disagreements. But when it's important, we sit down at the kitchen table and we talk. That's why we're here tonight. We need to talk. So who am I? My name is Sean Michael McCord. I'm a white, college-educated, middle-class family man. My wife is a teacher. We send our three kids to public schools. I write a blog. And the past 3 years have been pretty good to me. We bought a new house. I started a new job. We got a minivan. So why am I standing up here nervous as hell and talking about Iraq? Because my child went to war. My son, my daughter, my brother, my sister. These are our children, all of them, sent by our leaders to go kill someone else's child. This is our problem. This is the most important question facing our nation today. And when my three grade school children, who are here tonight, when they ask me, "What did you do in the war, Daddy?" I don't want to say, "Well, I wrote nasty things in my blog." I want to say to them, I am saying to them, "Kids, I did everything I could to wage peace and make this a better world for you." Look, here's the difference between an activist and a politician. An activist tells you what he thinks, and freely. A politician gets paid to tell you what to think. And I'm standing up here as an activist and telling you, I don't know what to do about Iraq. I'm not alone in this. George Bush doesn't know what to do about Iraq. We can't stay. We need to do something new. The majority of our country understands this. You don't need to be anti-war to understand. What you can be, and what I hope you will be after tonight, is pro-peace. I know light can shine sometimes in the darkest places. I know answers can be found in the smallest faces. Shadows fall because the world is round. The sun goes up and the sun goes down, and hope keeps coming back around. I love those lines. They're poetry set to music, and that music comes from our first guest, Terry Allard. Terry's website reads, "Terry Allard has an extraordinary talent for capturing the human spirit in her songs. With power-packed vocals and infectious energy, she has the uncanny ability of moving her audiences to pin-drop silence." That may be true, but tonight isn't about being silent. It's about making noise, and lots of it. So let's start making that noise right now by putting our hands together for Terry Allard.
Well, I'm here tonight, obviously, as a performer, but primarily and first and foremost, I am here tonight as a mother. And my little boy just turned 5 yesterday. That sounds so old! Don't you think? Oh, my gosh. There's something about the difference between 4 and 5 that just... And that word, kindergarten. But I think being a mother for me is really the reason, the main reason that I'm here tonight. And I can't even imagine the world without my little boy. I can't even for a moment imagine it. And I think that people like Cindy and all of us, I think we all have a right to question our president about the war. And obviously we are not alone, because otherwise no one would know who Cindy was, and we wouldn't be here tonight, would we? So I think some people describe her as a hero. And heroes are funny, aren't they? Because they come in so many shapes and sizes, and you don't always know who your heroes are going to be until that moment they become one. My little boy is often my hero. And my older brother, Scott, was always my hero. And we lost my brother, Scott, this past year to melanoma. And it's so funny when the heroes trade places. And I think, in a sense, perhaps Cindy and her son have been trading places and taking turns being heroes. And when my brother died and I told my little boy about it, he was so very sad. He was really quite heartbroken. And he, but the next day after I told him, he came up to me and he had on a superhero cape, because that was his thing at the time. And he said to me, "Mama, I'm going to build a spaceship and I'm going to go up to heaven and I'm going to get Uncle Scott and I'm going to bring him home."
Anne Wright spent 26 years in the U.S. Army and Army Reserves, attaining the rank of colonel. Ms. Wright then joined the Foreign Service in 1987, serving with distinction for 15 years. She received the State Department's Award for Heroism as Charge d'Affaires during the evacuation of Sierra Leone in 1997. She has dedicated her life to public service and the common good, no more so than when she resigned from the U.S. Foreign Service in March of 2003, while serving as Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Mongolia. In her letter to Secretary of State Colin Powell, she wrote, "This is the only time in my many years serving America that I have felt I cannot represent the policies of an administration of the United States. I believe the administration's policies are making the world a more dangerous, not a safer place. I feel obligated morally and professionally to set out my very deep and firm concerns on these policies and to resign from government service, as I cannot defend or implement them." She went on to write, "I strongly disagree with the use of preemptive attack against Iraq and believe that this policy will be used against us and provide justification for individuals and groups to preemptively attack America and American citizens. We should not give extremist Muslims a further cause to hate America or give moderate Muslims a reason to join the extremist." These are strong and prophetic words from a woman who has spent her life representing the U.S. in some of the most dangerous corners of the planet. Since leaving the Foreign Service, Ms. Wright has become a persistent advocate for justice and a strong voice in the peace movement. It is symbolic of how broadly our movement crosses cultural and social lines, and in the past few years, this former Army colonel has become such close friends with Cindy Sheehan. Organizing Camp Casey and joining in peaceful demonstrations around the country, I am proud to introduce our next speaker, Anne Wright.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here in Charlottesville. I was last here 20 years ago, I think, when I was in the Army. I attended a course that was offered right here at the University of Virginia, or at least on the campus of the University of Virginia, because you may not know it, but the U.S. Army has a school that's located right here in Charlottesville, right on the campus of the university. It's the Judge Advocate General School. Right? That's where they train military lawyers, and you have them right here. Yeah, right here in Charlottesville. And I came here as an Army major. I was teaching at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, at the School of International Studies, at the Special Warfare Center at Fort Bragg. And I came here to learn about the law of land warfare. The law of land warfare that this administration has thrown out. The Geneva Conventions. The Vienna Conventions. That our military lawyers learn about right here in your home in Charlottesville, Virginia. They learn about that it's illegal to torture. That indeed there are things that protect, there are international codes that protect people that we pick up on the battlefield, normally accorded a status called prisoner of war, which gives protections against things like torture, unnecessary interrogations, against renditions. These Army lawyers that live right now in your community are faced with a great moral dilemma. Now that an administration of the United States has said, we do not provide protections to anyone we pick up on a battlefield in Afghanistan because we're going to call them something different. We're going to call them enemy combatants, and they have no status at all. And so for the last 5 years, we've been having enemy combatants. Over 700 of them have been in Guantanamo and in Bagram Air Force Air Base in Afghanistan. And those people, as you well know, you've seen the pictures of them in the paper. You've seen them on the Internet. A new collection of photographs is now available on afterdowningstreet.org. These are pictures of things that these Army lawyers that are trained right here in your community know are wrong, that they're illegal. And these Army lawyers are faced with a difficult position. Because when you're in the military, and I was for 29 years, 13 on active duty and 16 in the reserves, and I retired as a colonel, while you're on active duty, or when you're in the reserves or the National Guard, you can't speak out against policies of an administration. Your job is to follow and implement the policies. And as a military person, if you want to go against them, you can, because you can go against illegal orders, but at risk of court-martial. Well, these military lawyers have had a difficult time, a great moral dilemma, because they have a president of the United States and an attorney general of the United States who have told them, throw out the Geneva Convention. Throw out the code of conduct that has guided U.S. military. And so what's happened? Well, you may not know it, but in fact, it's been our military lawyers who have been some of the greatest defenders of the rights of prisoners. It's been military lawyers. It's been the four top military lawyers of our military services, of the Army, the Marines, the Air Force, and the Navy, who took on the administration back in 2001 and who wrote memos to the General Counsel of Department of Defense. And to the Justice Department saying, do not undercut the Geneva Conventions. We plead of you because it puts our own military in jeopardy. Because if our men and women are picked up on a battlefield, what's going to happen to them? Probably the same thing that we're doing to those that we've picked up on the battlefield. The torture that we have given to those people in Afghanistan and Iraq, it'll come back on us. That's what the military lawyers told the civilian lawyers of this administration. So who won? Well, it wasn't the military. It was the civilian lawyers of the administration. Who protects the rights of those that are down in Guantanamo right now? Well, you have the Center for Constitutional Rights up in New York. You have the ACLU, and you have some private lawyers who have volunteered to be defense counsel for those that are in Guantanamo. But you also have military lawyers who have said, I will volunteer to be the defense for people that are in Guantanamo. And some of the most, we don't know all that they've said, but every now and then you get bits and pieces of things that they have said and done. So I would say what's going on here in Charlottesville is good, because the military lawyers are the ones that are trying to defend against the onslaught of the curtailment of civil liberties here in the United States, particularly for those that are captured by the United States and put in jail by the United States. So, let's see, Bill Anderson was talking about great speakers that you've had here. Well, I would say it would be really interesting if you would invite some of those military lawyers that are right here in your own community and hear some of the stories that they have to tell. Because 10 to 1, some of the people that are on the faculty of the Judge Advocates General School right now probably have been down in Guantanamo. And you just never can tell what might come up when they have a chance to talk. So I would encourage you to ask them as community members to come over and talk. The military, I spent 29 years of my life in it. And right now we have 2,445 military, U.S. military, that have been killed in Iraq. Actually, that's not true. This is the number that I put on the T-shirt last night for a talk in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Do you know what the number is today? It's 2,451. And do you know what it's going to be 2 weeks from now? It's going to be 2,500. And then do you know what it's going to be in 2 more months? 6 months? A year? The casualties keep growing in this war in Iraq. Right now, we know exactly where they are. We have had more Americans killed in 3 years in Iraq than we did in the first 3 years of the war in Vietnam. So if you want to continue on this pace, if you want to continue, if you think, for those of you all who have family members who may say, well, this war we need to continue. We can't get out now. We've got to continue. It would be dishonorable to impinge the honor of those who have died. Well, let's see. How many died in Vietnam? 58,000 before that was finally ended. And it started out just like this. Slow number, small number, small to those 2,451 families whose loved ones have been killed, and to the 150,000 Iraqis that have been killed either directly by our bullets or by our incompetency and probably or competency and deliberately, I think, tearing up civil infrastructure in Iraq. Water facilities, sewage facilities, electrical facilities, that if they weren't broken when we got in there, they got broken by the not-so-smart bombs. And incompetency, so that we spend billions and billions and billions of dollars to our great corporate masters of Halliburton, and they can't fix anything. They spend the money and nothing gets fixed, and so more and more Iraqis die because they don't have water. They don't have electricity to run the hospitals. So we've got a real mess on our hands. I, as a military person and a foreign service officer, well, I resigned in March of 2003 because I totally disagreed with us going to war in Iraq. I totally disagree with what this administration is doing to us right now, on the same lines of how they got the U.S. people to believe that there really was a threat from Iraq to American security, the fear that was engendered by these weapons of mass destruction. It's the same path that we're going on right now, the fear that's being engendered by the nuclear program of Iran. The same exact things are happening, the same exact chicken, lily-livered Congress that we had back in 2003. Those same ones that that allowed the administration the use of force in Iraq. They've already voted for the Iran Support Act, which is exactly what happened, you know, years ago for the Iraq Support Act, which means millions of dollars to go in to destabilize the government. Well, that's the first step. And here we have lots of congressmen and women that we thought were anti-war in Iraq. And what did they go around and do? And they just voted for the Iran Support Act. I mean, what in the world is going on here? It's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. And that's why we've got to stand up. We, the people, have to take the lead. After me, I've been a public servant for 35 years of my life. I had kept my mouth shut on a lot of stuff that probably should have resigned over. I mean, it certainly hasn't been a pretty 35 years. I've been in Grenada, Nicaragua, Somalia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Sierra Leone. I helped reopen the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan in December of 2001. So I've seen a lot. I've done a lot. Probably should have resigned earlier, but now I'm resigned, and now I speak my mind. And it's something that we all ought to be doing. Now that I'm not in government service, I can speak whatever I want to, and hopefully it's with a good, solid basis of information and analysis and background. But it's my obligation. If I quit my job, there's no point in sitting on my couch and just smoldering. I got to go out and speak. So that's what I do. I speak about the role of dissent in democracy, the obligation and responsibilities of all of us to stand up when we see something that's going wrong and to tell our government when we see something our government's doing wrong. I mean, if we don't, silence is complicity. So if you want to be complicit in what is going on in today's world that the United States is sponsoring, then you just sit back and do nothing. But if you see something going wrong, then you, well, let's see, I think they have something in the buses and on the subways. If you see something, say something. And they're talking about the war on terror. If you see a bag, tell us, you know. Well, I say, if you see something like, oh, let's just say, a Secretary of State that lies about torture and illegal detentions, well, then you say something about it. Yeah. If you see that a president of the United States is authorizing illegal wiretaps and allowing corporate media people to communications people to have the greatest data mining into our telephone records, then you say something about that. If you see that the Secretary of Defense is ordering the use of chemical weapons on the people of Iraq, like phosphorus, white phosphorus, like enhanced napalm, like the purposeful razing, knocking down of villages, if you see something like that, what do we do? We say something. That's right. Because we can't be silent. Silence is not what we can do these days. We have to stand up. We will not be silent. And that's where you come in. I mean, what can you be doing right now? We've just had this last weekend in Washington, D.C., that we had a 24-hour vigil in front of the White House. Mothers Say No to War. 24 hours, hundreds of mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers were in front of the White House for 24 hours. Actually sleeping in Lafayette Park, which is illegal. Sleeping, you can't sleep in the parks of Washington, but guess what? The mothers slept in the park of Washington at Lafayette in front of the White House. We're going to have lots of things that will be happening this summer that we have to participate in. Because if we don't, this administration will say to themselves, that public doesn't care. Look what we've gotten over on them. We got Iraq over on them. Now we can do Iran. How many times have there been protests out in front of the White House against what looks to be a policy to at least bomb, if not do other things to Iran? How many have we had? How many demonstrations? I can tell you, a big fat zero. But guess what's happening tomorrow? Tomorrow afternoon there will be a demonstration to tell the administration hands off of Iran. And it's actually being sponsored from right here in Charlottesville. David Swanson and after Downing Street, sponsoring a demonstration in Washington, D.C. Ray McGovern, Cindy Sheehan, a whole bunch of folks are going to be there. And they're going to be presenting a petition signed by over 40,000 Americans. A petition that says, don't bomb Iran. Hands off Iran. Pardon me. So if you want to do something, take tomorrow off. I mean, school, how many of y'all are still in school? Good. Is this about the last week? Have you already done your finals? Good. Well, take time off. Even if you're in finals, I'd say it's so important. You shouldn't miss a final. But right now we're getting down to the wire on some very important stuff. Whether or not we're going to be able to keep our country together, and if we the people don't get out on the streets and tell the administration back off of what you're doing, they're going to continue right on. So we've got to take some big actions. We got to support things like going to Washington tomorrow to protest against bombing of Iran. We've got to tell the administration we need to get out of Iraq. We need to get out of Iraq right now. We need to get the troops home right now. The Iraqis can get this thing solved. I mean, we certainly have made a big, big mess of this, and as long as we're there, it'll continue to be a mess. You might as well just paint a bullseye on every American that's there, whether it's American military, American diplomats. I mean, the biggest embassy in the whole world, bigger than the Vatican, is going in Baghdad. I don't even know. From me, I served in mostly small embassies all over the world. I can't imagine what in the world they're going to be doing with a facility that's bigger than the Vatican. And especially when you have to stay inside the walls, the green zone. Well, it's kind of like the green zone we ought to put around the White House. We ought to make that a green zone and make the President of the United States fear for going out. Not fear for his life, but fear for his reputation. We need to do that because he needs to be put on notice. And actually he is. You know, every time he escapes that green zone in Washington, that White House, he has to fly out, he has to helicopter out, and then he goes to places all over the country. And guess what happens when he gets there? There are protesters that are there. There are people that are coming into the auditoriums to ask the President of the United States, why is this such a noble cause? Why are we still in there? We have people like Ray McGovern that are standing up to the Secretary of Defense to say, you're lying, Mr. Secretary of Defense. I had a little hand in that in October of last year. I just happened to be in Washington passing through. At breakfast time, I picked up the Washington Post, you know, and just read through what's going on in Congress. Well, lo and behold, at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, guess who was testifying for the first time since her confirmation in February of 2005? Why, it's our dear Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. So she was going to go over to the Senate on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to talk about Iraq. I mean, the first time that she had testified. And that was 10 months. So I thought, well, I'm going to run over there. It's probably too late because the lines must be out onto the street for people that want to go in there and hear what she has to say. Well, much to my surprise, when I got there, there was a very short line going into the committee room. And I got in and sat down. And for 2 hours, I sat there. Actually, I thought surely I'd see some of my friends, some of my activist friends, my newfound activist friends that knew what to do when you go into committee hearing rooms. Because I certainly didn't. I'd never been in one before. And Condoleezza started talking about Iraq and Iraq and Iraq and Iraq. And actually, the senators asked her some pretty good questions. And then, if you remember back in October, there was this big brouhaha about what Syria was doing and what Iran was doing. Well, the senators started grilling her. They said, you know, we've been hearing that you all are talking behind closed doors about a military option on Syria and maybe one on Iran. And Condoleezza Rice just pretty dismissively just went, all options are on the table everywhere. We'll do, essentially, she was saying, we'll do what we want to. Well, the senator said, well, now, wait a minute. We have only given you the administration authorization for use of force in Iraq, not in Syria or Iran. You have to come back to us, and you tell us what's going on. Well, she again just dismissively just We'll do what we want to, is essentially what she was saying. So I thought, come on, senators, you know, let's have some spine, some backbone. Let's get after that woman. I mean, she's just, you know, stiffing you on this question. They just sat there. Well, you know, sometimes it's just like you're kind of having an out-of-body experience. All of a sudden, your feet start moving and your legs start moving, and all of a sudden, you're on your feet and you're going, stop the killing, stop the war. Don't let that woman bamboozle us again. They led us to war in Iraq. Don't let them do it in Iran. Stop the killing, stop the war. Well, you know, it was quite remarkable. It really didn't hurt at all to do that. It didn't hurt at all, except I found out that you need, if you're going to do that, you need to kind of plan out what you're going to say, because you all of a sudden I was out of words. I'd said what I needed to say, and there was kind of silence there. But there was this one police officer that was starting to walk around the corner of the room coming toward me. And I knew that, you know, if you protest, you get hauled out of there. But he was going really slowly, like kind of like he enjoyed what I was saying. So I really didn't have anything else except just stop the killing, stop the war. Don't let her get us into another war. Don't let her get us into Iran. And by that time, the police officer came up. Ma'am, you know, you're not supposed to yell in here. I'll have to ask to take you out. Well, some friends of mine that saw some of this on, I guess, C-SPAN or something said that it was about the first time they'd ever seen a protester put her arm around a police officer, like, thank you. So off we went, but it was still silent, and the senators were sitting up there just like bumps on a log. And so I thought, well, you know, we can't go out in silence. So again, stop the killing, stop the war, don't let us go into Iran. Well, they went out. Well, lo and behold, what happened? Well, sometimes they arrest you, sometimes they don't. Turned out that Senator Lugar, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, declined to have me prosecuted. Well, why did he decline that, I wonder? Well, the only thing I can think of, that he was glad that the people, a person from the peanut gallery, stood up and tried to help the Senate, tried to help them stave off this onslaught that the executive part of our government is doing on the Congress. So I say that, hey, it doesn't hurt a bit. Every time one of these yahoos comes anywhere close to where you live or where you're visiting, in fact, start tracking them. We need to make sure that every time the vice president, the secretary of defense, the secretary of state, the attorney general speak, you ought to be there to say your piece, to speak your mind. And anytime any of these senators or congressmen or women that are there that you know aren't doing what they ought to be doing, that aren't reflecting the wishes of the people of the United States, which right now 70% of the people of the United States say this war needs to end. It needs to end now. So you just take them on. Take them on. And there are a few upcoming events that you can do that. I don't know if you know, Hillary Clinton has not been any friend to the peace community. I mean, so on May 23rd at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., there's a breakfast for Hillary. So it's $18 if you're a member of the press club and $30 if you're not. Good breakfast, lots of opportunities to tell Hillary what you think. Okay, June 23rd, a postponement from June 2nd. Explosive testings in Nevada. I mean, our government is getting back in this thing of let's test something. First, they're going to test to see if we have the resolve to stop a test of explosives, non-nuclear, they say. And if we don't stop that, then what do you think is going to be the next one? They'll just try to test for the first time in how many years? Just do another little nuclear test. So we got to go out in Nevada on the 20th. The reason they postponed it, I'm sure, on the 2nd is because there was an outcry from the public saying we don't want that radioactive dust that's all over Nevada, we don't want it stirred up by the biggest explosive explosion that's been held in decades. We don't want that stuff going up in the air and coming east into Charlottesville. So we've got to stand up for this. Memorial Day. What are you doing on a Memorial Day? Well, I think you ought to at least have the number 2,500 on your sleeve, because that's what it's going to be by Memorial Day, probably. What are you going to do in August? Well, we're going to have Camp Casey. We're going to have Camp Casey in the back door, the backyard of the President of the United States again. So you all ought to come out to that. Since Cindy Sheehan went to Camp Casey, went to Crawford in Texas in August of last year, and 12,000 of you came there to visit in 26 days. Since that time, we went back at Thanksgiving and at Easter. At Easter, it was the first time the President of the United States had not visited his Crawford estate in the 5 years that he had been president. He didn't show up at Easter. Hey! So I invite you to come, and I'm sure Cindy will in just a minute, to invite you all to come to one of the most unique experiences that you'll ever have in your whole life. And you, as peace activists, are the people that will get so much energy and so much oomph by being in hot, dusty, rattlesnake-infested, fire ants, chiggers, ticks. I mean, it is tough on one level, but it's the most exhilarating place that you can ever be in August. To be there with friends that sole purpose is to put pressure on the United States, on the President of the United States, to stop this illegal, immoral war of aggression, this war crime that this president has committed. So I invite you to be there. Come with us. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
See, I'm doing a little math here. 150,000 Iraqis dead, $300 billion. Comes out to $2 million per dead Iraqi. You know, for half that, we could have just gone in there and just made a lot of friends. Casey Sheehan grew up in a devout Catholic home. He was an altar boy and an Eagle Scout. He joined the Army when he was 20 years old and trained as a mechanic. Casey re-enlisted in 2004, knowing full well that he could be sent into combat. Specialist Sheehan was a Humvee mechanic with the 1st Battalion, 82nd Field Artillery Regiment. In March of that year, his unit was sent to Iraq. On April 4, 2004, Palm Sunday, Casey had just returned from Mass and volunteered to join a QRF, a quick reaction force put together to rescue a group of soldiers from another battalion that were pinned down by snipers during an attempted incursion into Sadr City. Not long after entering the Mahdi area, the QRF was channeled onto a dead-end street where the roofs were lined with snipers, RPGs, and militia throwing burning tires under the vehicles from the roofs above. Casey's vehicle was hit with multiple RPGs and automatic weapons fire. The 20 soldiers trapped in that dead-end alley on a rescue mission, only 13 returned. Casey Sheehan died in the arms of his best friend. He was 24 years old. In June of 2004, Casey Sheehan's mother, Cindy Sheehan, along with other military families whose children had recently been killed, met with President George Bush. It was, by all accounts, a strange meeting. In January of 2005, Cindy Sheehan became one of the founding members of Gold Star Families for Peace, an organization that seeks to end the occupation of Iraq and provide support for families of fallen soldiers. In August of 2005, Cindy established Camp Casey outside of George Bush's Crawford, Texas ranch, promising to stay there during his entire 5-week vacation or until he met with her to explain why her son had to die in a warrantless war. Cindy did not get to meet with the president in Texas, but thousands of people joined her in her vigil. Bush did eventually acknowledge Cindy's presence outside his ranch, telling the press, "I think it's important for me to be thoughtful and sensitive to those who've got something to say. But I think it's also important for me to go on with my life. I think the people want the president to be in a position to make good, crisp decisions and to stay healthy. And part of my being is to be outside exercising. So I'm mindful of what goes on around me. On the other hand, I'm also mindful that I've got a life to live and will do so." George Bush said all that, then rode off on his bicycle. Sadly, his vacation was eventually interrupted by another powerful woman named Katrina, who was busy destroying New Orleans while the president was riding his bike and making good, crisp decisions. Cindy Sheehan wrote this: "The challenge of the peace movement is to convince each and every last American that he or she has a very intimate and personal stake in what we are allowing our government to do in Iraq and the world. We are not just outsourcing our torture to other countries or paying private mercenary contractors to do it. By sitting on our duffs and allowing the torturing to continue, we are the torturers. We are the subhuman beings who put the black mask on our victims, waterboard them, or do other inhumane and despicable acts on fellow human beings." Fighting for peace has become Cindy Sheehan's full-time occupation. The Reverend Lennox Yarwood, Jr. calls her the Rosa Parks of the anti-war movement. I am humbled and deeply honored to introduce our final speaker tonight, Casey Sheehan's mom, Cindy Sheehan.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Charlottesville. Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank the Charlottesville Center for Peace and Justice for inviting me here. And it really wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for David Swanson, who has been nagging the crap out of me for months. But he can do that. Dave and I have been friends since May of last year, so just about a year, when we, Close Our Families for Peace, was one of the first organizations on board with AfterDowningStreet.org. And one thing that wonderful introduction left out was June of 2005, I testified in the basement for the Downing Street memo hearings for Congressman John Conyers. That's what I thought was going to be the tipping point. I thought when America heard that, they were going to rise up in peaceful arms to stand against this government. And that's where Anna and I met. And, you know, the rest is history. We know that the people did not rise up. They didn't really care that George Bush lied and that, you know, thousands and thousands of people were dead. Little did I know, in just less than 2 months, really, on August 6, 2005, that would be the tipping point when we went to Crawford, Texas to confront the president. I said that day, this is the beginning of the end of the occupation of Iraq. And I believe I was right, because look at what's happened since then. And David, although he hates me to tell him, this is my hero. He's one of my heroes. He is the glue that holds the peace movement together. If it wasn't for David, I don't know where we would be right now. I told David, we need a petition saying, don't attack Iran. I think within 20 minutes, we had it online. We had a website, and we had a petition. And he says, oh, I'm not a hero. I'm not a hero. And I said, you can't tell me who's my hero. And you're one of my heroes. And another one of my heroes is Anne Wright. And I just hope when I grow up, I'm going to be just like her. But I don't really think she has to grow up first, too. So I'm not saying that we're immature or childish, but we're childlike. And we have a lot of fun. And Anne is an amazing woman. I learn more and more about her every day. Today I just learned she was she had a commercial pilot's license. And it's just like, you know, traveling with a barrel full of monkeys with Anne, and I learn something new every day. And it's really nice to have a woman friend who loves beer as much as I do. Oh, I could go on and on and on, but I won't. So I have a shirt on that says, Impeach Bush and Cheney. I don't know why that Everybody says that's impossible. But I don't believe anything is impossible. And I believe that we have to call, you know, what Ann calls our cowardly and spineless Congress people to do the job that they were elected to do. They were elected to protect our rights, not take them away from us. And every time that they vote almost in unison together for everything George Bush wants done, it's a rubber stamp, bobble-headed Congress that won't stand up and say, no, this is not good for America. And I have a funny little story. I was in Venezuela in January. Thank you. Yay, Venezuela. Yay, President Chavez. And I was speaking at a huge rally. I couldn't even see the end of it. There were probably like 300,000 people. We had a march that was miles long. It lasted for a long time. Finally got to the rallying point, and I was one of the last speakers. And I was giving a rousing speech to all these people, very enthusiastic people from Latin America. You know, viva, viva, all the time. And I got to the end of my speech, and when I go around the world, I'm almost embarrassed to be an American. You know, because they said, if you reelect George Bush, we're not going to have any good feelings for you anymore. You know, we can understand making one mistake, but every 4 years you Americans have a chance to correct it. And if you don't correct that mistake, we're not cutting you any more slack. So I go all over the country, I'm all over the world, just kind of embarrassed to be American. And this time I was saying, you can rest assured that there are people in America who are working really hard to end this war. We're working really hard to have George Bush impeached. And so my translator said that. He translated into Spanish. And people were yelling, yay! You know, they're screaming. And my next step is, and that's not enough. Once he is impeached, he must be removed from office. Found guilty of his crimes and removed from office. Yay, Charlottesville likes that idea too. And so I said, and not only must he be removed from office, he must be tried for war crimes. And my translator translated what I said, and the crowd went insane. They're, Viva Cindy! Viva Cindy! And I was like, wow, I kicked ass! Yes! And so I didn't know until I left Venezuela about, you know, 5 or 6 days later, and I was already in customs in the United States, that some lady ran up to me. She said, Cindy, I'm bilingual. I said, well, congratulations. And she said, No, you don't understand. I was at the rally, the very first rally at the World Social Forum. And I said, okay. And she said, well, let me tell you a funny little story. And I went, okay. She said, when you said impeach, your translator said impeach. When you said found guilty and removed from office, your translator said found guilty and removed from office. And when you said tried for war crimes, your translator said executed. And so, at first my heart stopped, because I could just see, you know, me trying to get through customs after advocating for the execution of the president. But then I thought, how can they stop me for saying that? You know, many people, when they're found guilty of murder, are executed in our country. It's legal. Execution is legal. Now, I'm not advocating for the execution of the president because I don't believe in the death penalty. I'm a pacifist. And now whenever I go to another country, I have a little disclaimer. I always say, no matter what you hear, if you hear me advocating any kind of violence or death, it's a mistranslation. Because I'm not for the death penalty or state-sanctioned murder, even for mass murderers. But George Bush is responsible for killing my son. My introduction said that he was killed by insurgents in the Mahdi army that were loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr. But like I told Barbara Bush in a letter, your son might as well pull the trigger. Your son was the one that killed my son. And when is George Bush, and when I say George Bush, I mean everybody in the administration who lied to us, when are they going to be held accountable for the crimes against humanity that they have committed on the world, not just America? This is, I believe, May 17th. Oh, good. Yay. In 12 more days, it'll be Casey's birthday on May 29th. He was born on Memorial Day in 1979. And Monday, May 29th, will be Memorial Day again. Ann said, what will you be doing on Memorial Day? Well, I will be at my son's grave, and we're going to have a dedication ceremony for his tombstone. That's where I'm going to be on Memorial Day. And Memorial Day will never be a day of barbecuing and getting together with people, just having a three-day weekend for me ever again. Memorial Day will be the day that I grieve my son's death and also grieve his birth. You know, the death day is a very sad day. When we just passed Casey's second death day. But you're supposed to be sad on that day. On their birthdays, it's supposed to be a happy time. We always had his birthday on Memorial Day. We would have people over for barbecue, swimming. We lived in California. It was always nice. You know, this is May. It's supposed to be nice, and I've been freezing all over the country. But we would just get together and celebrate the day that my oldest child was born, was brought into this world. On Memorial Day, I'll be mourning. I'll be crying at my son's grave. Not that I don't cry every day for Casey, but some days are just harder. I just passed Mother's Day. That's never going to be a celebration for me. That will always be a day of mourning to me, even though I have three other children. But I'm a mother of four. I'm not a mother of three. I gave birth to four children. I should never have had to bury one of them. That's disordered, and that's not natural. And it was unnecessary. And it was cold-blooded murder. It was calculated by our government that used my son as cannon fodder to enrich the war machine. On May 29th was also, Casey would be 27 this year if he was still alive. But it was the day that John F. Kennedy was born also. And Casey was killed on April 4th, 2004. But April 4th was also the day that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. And I don't believe in coincidences. He was born and died on the day that two Americans were assassinated. And I believe that they were assassinated because they rose up against the war machine. They rose up against the military-industrial complex. And you don't do that in this country. So we're talking about impeachment. And we should be talking about impeachment. You know, if anybody deserved to be impeached, it's George Bush. Not only has Ann outlined every treaty that he's ever broken, but by breaking treaties, he's breaking our own constitution that says that treaties are the highest law of our land. You know, it's Article something. You know, I quote the Constitution like Catholics quote the Bible. It says somewhere in the Bible. Well, I know it says somewhere in the Constitution that treaties are the highest law of our land. And for him to break the treaties with the UN, with the Geneva Conventions, he also broke our Constitution. But he doesn't care. He says it's an old scrap of paper. Well, you know what? The Ten Commandments were a lot older than the Constitution. And he breaks those every time he opens his mouth, too. But I believe that he, if anybody, has committed high crimes and misdemeanors, it's George Bush. But let's forget about the misdemeanors. He has high crimes as long as my arm. I don't think we should be talking about impeachment anyway. I think for somebody to be impeached, he should have been elected in the first place. George Bush was never elected. And that's what I tell people in other countries. They say, well, you know, you made that mistake the first time. I said, no, we didn't. We elected Al Gore. And people, that's another thing. People always ask me, who do you like for 2008? I say, well, so far I like Al Gore. And they say, well, do you think he can be elected? I say, why not? He was elected one time. Why can't he be elected again? He's only gotten stronger. So I say, no, George Bush was not elected in 2000. He was appointed. He was appointed by the Supreme Court. And then they say, what about 2004? I say, well, there was voting machines. There was voting fraud. There was voter suppression. There was gay marriage ballots in 9 different states. And they kept it so close by also the fear that they tried to instill in us that if we, you know, changed horsemen in the middle of the apocalypse, that, you know, it would be a bad thing to do. So I say we didn't elect him in 2004 either. He kept it close enough so they could freaking cheat. And so the people in other countries say, we understand that. We know that. But why is he still your president? They don't understand why we weren't out in the streets by the millions. And you know what? I don't understand that either. The very next day, I was out in front of the federal building in Sacramento, California, in the pouring down rain, protesting another stolen election. And the day after that, I wrote him an open letter, and I say, you think you got away with something, but you didn't get away with anything, because I'm going to work till my dying breath to make sure you're impeached for what you've done to my family and for the country. But, so why should we impeach somebody that was never elected? I say we need an eviction movement. That we need evict BushandCheney.org. We need to get millions of us surrounding the White House and say, you get out of our house. You're ruining it. You're peeing in the corners. We want our house back. And we know that millions of Americans are with us, but where are they? We don't see them. If all those people surrounded the White House, I think they'd have to listen to us. You know, and we're not going to give them any notice. They don't get a 5-day, 4-day, 3-day. We're saying, you get out of our house now. And we'll go in and we'll pile their crap on the lawn. We'll sell some of it. We'll start to reduce the deficit. Okay, David, you got a job. EvictBushandCheney.org. And we have 42,000 signatures on our Iran don'tattackiran.org petition. Why don't we have 42 million signatures on that petition? What is the matter with our Congress? I talked to one of our congressmen, Major Owens, and who I had promoted to a colonel, but he voted for the Iran Freedom Support Act. And I said, why did you do that? He said, because I don't like the evil regime of Iran. I said, what about our evil regime? Why are you giving them more power? You're demoted to a private. You can't give this man any more power. He doesn't care if the Congress gives it to him. He just takes it. He is busy concentrating all powers. Congress is illegitimate. Congress has no power anymore. George Bush has taken all the power, mostly by his signing statements. Oh, I'll sign this bill, but I'm going to make a little statement that says I don't have to obey this law that I'm signing. So we're going to have a question and answer period after this. And I always get a question, and it's worded the exact same way every time. And I really think that it's somebody posing being a supporter, but it's being paid by Free Republic, a freeper, to come in and ask me this question. And so I'm going to take away your pay because I'm going to ask the question and answer it right now so you don't have to. So you can go back and tell your handlers that you asked me the question. I don't care if you get the money or not. So, this is a question. So, Cindy. Yeah. We all know the war was wrong. We know George Bush lied to us. We know that our troops never should have been there. But now that they're there, don't you think they should stay? This is a question. Don't you think it's despicable to want to abandon the people of Iraq? I tell you, I get this every single time there's a Q&A. So I'm going to answer it now to save time. You don't care about the people of Iraq, and our government does not care about the people of Iraq. They have killed tens of thousands of innocent Iraqis. They say to get rid of one man. I want to ask you, Mr. Freeper, why didn't Donald Rumsfeld take Saddam Hussein out when he was shaking his hand back in 1984? And I also want to ask you a question, Mr. Freeper. It's always a mister. It's never a miss or a missus. I will have to live the rest of my life wondering if my son was killed by a weapon given to Saddam by the United States of America. And who gave him those weapons? George Bush Sr. Donald Rumsfeld, when Saddam was our friend. Saddam was our friend in the war against Iran, but you know what? We were supplying both sides of that war with weapons. We don't care who we sell our weapons to or who they kill. And another thing, to think that the United States of America and coalition forces have to keep our troops in there to help Iraq solve the problems we cause is arrogant and racist. To think that they need us there. And people always ask me, well, how would you fight a war on terror? And I always say, not with a war of terror. And that's what George Bush is waging. He's waging a war of terror on the world. And why are you asking me about Iraq? Why don't you ask the Iraqi people what they want? It's their country. And they're being governed by a puppet government put in place by the United States of America. And if any of their leaders say anything that wasn't, their strings weren't pulled by America, they're removed. So how can people say that this government cares anything about the Iraqi people? The peace movement cares about the Iraqi people. And you know what? The peace movement has been right all along about Iraq. We were the ones that were right. But you know what? It doesn't feel good being right. I wish we were wrong. But we weren't. We were right. Well, so that's the answer to your question. No, we don't abandon the people of Iraq. We give them all the money they need for reparations, quit voting more money for killing. We have to hold our Congress accountable for giving George Bush more money to wage his war of terror. And we have to say, stop funding it. Stop giving this maniac more money to kill more people. It would be like one of my kids coming up and say, Mom, can I have some money to buy a gun to rob the liquor store? And they're going, oh, yeah, sure. Congress is funding George Bush's war crimes. And we're funding George Bush's war crimes by paying our taxes. And that's one thing that I'll never do again, is fund the government's war crimes. I'm not going to pay taxes. And if they come after me and say, you owe your taxes, I'll say, you give me back my son, and I'll pay your stinking taxes. You change the War Department to the Department of Peace, and I'll start paying taxes again. But I'm not going to support and I'm not going to fund something that I think is so reprehensible. And I think what George Bush does is reprehensible. None of that money trickles down to our soldiers. None of the money trickles down to our communities. They want to build a country where the only recourse our children have is to join the military. And I think that anybody who wants to go to college in this country should be able to go for free. I don't think they should make it such a prohibitive cost that our children have to join the military. I think that our money needs to stay in our communities and not given to our government to commit more crimes. People always tell me, Cindy, this is not another Vietnam. And like Ann said, this is worse than Vietnam. In Vietnam, we had 58,000 of our children killed. Over 120,000 have committed suicide since Vietnam. Do we want that to happen again? Because, like Ann said, with the 14 permanent bases and an embassy the size of 17 football fields, it has its own power source and its own clean water where the people of Iraq don't have power and clean water yet. They are planning on never bringing our kids home. They're planning on never leaving Iraq. They're planning on using Iraq as a base to spread corporate colonialism around the Middle East. And to Mr. Freeper, I say, close the permanent bases, get the contractors out of there, give Iraqi people back their jobs, and they'll stop killing. They won't be killing our soldiers because our soldiers won't be there, and they won't be killing each other because they'll have jobs. They'll have communities that they're building themselves. People always tell me from Iraq, they say, we don't have a Sunni community here and a Shia community here and a Kurd community here. We're all intermarried. We live together. We work together. We have children together. The only reason we're killing each other is because the United States is fomenting this rebellion in our country. And if you look back in history, and I also think that we not only need a Department of Peace, but we need a Department of History. And we need a Secretary of History that says, oh, no, 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 no. This has never worked before. What makes you think it's going to work now? But the hallmark of an occupation is chaos and confusion. If we keep the people stirred up, if we keep them in fear and chaos and confined to their homes and out of schools and out of their jobs, they won't notice that we're stealing all their oil. They won't notice that we're stealing their natural resources and usurping all of their treasure for ourselves. And they'll be so busy fighting each other that they won't be able to fight Americans. But we know that they're dying. In May is going to be one of the deadliest months. So far, there's 54, and this is May 17th. Over 3 a day have been killed this month. And we don't notice it because you know what we're noticing? We're noticing the bird flu threat. we're noticing that some lacrosse players, you know, raped a co-ed. That's what we're noticing, and they're not showing us that our soldiers are being killed at an unprecedented clip in Iraq right now. What can we do as a peace movement? Well, I already said that we shouldn't fund the crimes against humanity, but that's a moral choice that everybody has to make. And a lot of you don't have the same excuse that I have, that you killed my son for lies. You killed my son to line the pockets of the war machine. You killed my son so the CEO of Exxon could retire with a $400 million package. You killed my son so I could pay $3.59 for gas. No, I'm not paying your taxes anymore. And if I live to be 100, I won't owe you a penny ever again. But we do. You know, we can stop paying our telephone tax. I'm sure a lot of you already do that. The telephone tax that goes to the war crimes and crimes against humanity that our government commits. But else, what else can we do as a peace movement? On July 4th of this year, a core group of us are going to start what we're calling Troops Home Fast. And some of us are going on a water-only fast, and some of us are going on a liquids-only fast. And we're going to fast until the troops come home. And we're going to call people in America to join us, like in 24-hour intervals. We're going to ask them to join us in rallies to promote the fast. And that's going to be announced here in Washington, D.C. on July 4th. That's going to be our Independence Day, from extra weight. Our Independence Day from extra calories. And we're going to do this until our troops are home from Iraq. We'll be joined by Dick Gregory, who is a famous faster from the Vietnam War. He did it for 2.5 years till the troops came home in Vietnam. He still looks really healthy, so I'm hoping that we're going to survive this. And what else can we do? We can support war resistors. I was just in Canada, and a lot of our young people are seeking asylum there because they don't want to commit murder in Iraq. They're saying, I could go to jail for murdering somebody, but I can also go to jail for not wanting to murder somebody. That doesn't seem right. And this war, we've already proven, is illegal and it's immoral. And like Anne Wright said, our kids do not have to obey unlawful orders. And I don't think their choice should have to be to go over and kill innocent people or go to prison. I think that if they don't want to participate in their organization's mission statement, they shouldn't have to. One of the things that these Freepers also say to me is that Cindy Casey volunteered. This is an all-volunteer army. Well, if we believe that, that's not even true. But if we believe that, if they volunteer, then they should be able to unvolunteer without going to prison. Does that make sense? But we have a lot of kids heading across the border in Canada. We need to encourage the Canadian government to give our kids asylum again like they did in Vietnam, even if they are volunteers, because they volunteered for something that their leaders are exploiting. You know, people always say Casey volunteered like, well, Casey volunteered so he deserved what he got. No, that's not true. Casey volunteered had the best intentions when he volunteered. But George Bush, the chicken hawk, who went AWOL from the Alabama Air National Guard, and Dick Cheney, who got 5 deferments, and all the rest of the chicken hawks in Congress, are misusing our children. I don't give them or blame them for getting out of the Vietnam War. I think everybody should have gotten out of the Vietnam War. But some people didn't have the means like George and Dick did to get out of the Vietnam War. But when they grow up and they lead our country into another bullshit war, that's what I have a problem with. On June 15th, Gold Star Families for Peace and Iraq Veterans Against the War are going to have a fundraiser to help the war resistors in Canada pay their legal expenses and pay their living expenses. And then on the 16th, we're going to walk across a peace bridge in Buffalo, New York, and we're going to deliver the money to the war resistors. And you can go to Gold Star Families for Peace, GSFP.org, and find more information. I've given many hundreds of dollars to soldiers who said, I don't want to go to war. And I say, well, here, you go and you live your life. And these are not cowardly kids. These are kids of high moral standards who have searched their souls and decided that the organization that they volunteered for does not fit them anymore. And I've volunteered in a lot of organizations and I've never had to face prison for that. And I don't think our young people should have to either. So like Anne has said, whatever you're doing now, you can do a little bit more. Anne and I'm not bragging or, you know, I'm not saying that you have to be like Anne and I, who have given up everything to traverse the world speaking out for peace. But if we can do what we can do, you can do just a little bit more for peace. People always say, do you think you're going to win, Cindy? I say, we're winning every day. We've made huge strides since August, and every day we're prevailing against George Bush. He will be held accountable, and we can't say it's impossible. We have to go to our congresspeople and expect it. Don't go there and ask them, pretty please, will you look into this for us? No, you go, you work for us. You will do what we say because we employ you. And if you don't do what we say, we're going to fire you. And it's coming up pretty soon that you're going to be fired and we'll replace you with someone who will do what we say. Because we here in America, we the people are the ones that have the power. There's only 535 of them and who knows how many in the administration. I don't even want to count because they're all useless. It's wasting my time even counting them. But we're the ones with the power, and when are we going to get surround the White House with millions of us saying, get out of our house. Thank you.
Give Cindy and Anne a minute to settle down. This is our Q&A. We've got a microphone here and a microphone here. If you want to ask questions, come on up. We've got a volunteer to help you. We're giving you, is it 2 minutes?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. But although we're giving you 2 minutes, we'd still rather have questions, not speeches. And Cindy, if I can ask the first question, there have been a few conflicting accounts of your meeting with George Bush a few months after Casey died. So can you take a moment now to tell us, since you were there, what actually happened in that meeting? And what were your impressions of George?
Well, that's going to take longer than a few minutes, but, you know, the Reader's Digest version is that we were invited to Fort Lewis, Washington to meet with the president. We were told he wanted to have a sit-down with us. I took five framed pictures of Casey. As a family, we decided we weren't going to challenge him on the reasons for the war. We wanted to use the short time we had with him to show him Casey and to talk about Casey. And he didn't want to look at the pictures. He never said Casey's name. He called him your loved one. He never even say him or her. You know, he wouldn't say him. He would say your loved one. And he called me mom the whole time. He didn't even know our names. He didn't know Casey's name. He walked in here. He said, so who are we honoring here? And we couldn't believe that the leader of the free world didn't even know our son's name. And my children, my other three children were there too. And he walked up to my daughter, Carly, who is very outspoken. I don't know where she got that from. And he said, I wish I could bring your loved one. I'm a gifted mimic, by the way. I wish I could bring your loved one back to fill the hole in your heart. And Carly goes, yeah, so do we. And he goes, I'm sure you do. And he turned his back on her and ignored her for the rest of the time. Then he came up to me one time and he said, Mom, I can't imagine losing a loved one. whether it be an aunt, an uncle, a cousin. He was like going, saying everything except son. You know, and cousin third removed. And I went, hold on a second. Casey was my son. And I think you can imagine it because you have daughters. I said, try to imagine if one of your daughters was killed in this war. And I said, trust me, you don't even want to go there. And he told me, you're right, I don't. So this is what happened when we met with him. He was callous. His eyes didn't match what his heart was saying. And we could tell he was already on to the next thing. He wasn't even really present there with us. And, you know, it took us a while to process it because, number one, we were all still in a state of shock. The shock doesn't even wear off for like a year. And after the shock wears off, that's when the real pain sets in. So anyway, that's basically what happened. And then, oh, and I said, why did you invite us? We didn't vote for you, and we're not going to vote for you again. And he said, it's not about politics, Mom. And I was like, okay, peace, Dad. No, I didn't say that. And so then he comes out in the RNC when he accepted the nomination and said, I meet with the families of the fallen. They tell me that they're praying for me and to complete the mission. And so I said, well, I don't know why I believed him, but that's when I started to actively campaign against him for the 2004 election. So.
Okay, we're going to do alternate microphones here, and I'm going to start with on my left.
I have a real quick question. What do those bumper stickers mean that people drive around with on their car that say support our troops?
I think what they really mean is support the president. You know, because they're not supporting the troops. By supporting the president, you're harming the troops. And by being pro-Bush means you're pro-Bush means you're anti-American. George Bush is nothing about American values. We don't torture. We don't kill innocent people. You know, we don't imprison people without due process. So I really think, because I always say, you know, you have to support the troops. You have to support their mission. Why? You know, I think the only way we can support our troops now is to get them the hell out of there.
And well, on my right.
Definitely want to thank you, ladies. The country owes you a great debt for what you do. And
thank you.
I certainly wouldn't want to lose this little guy to this machine.
Yeah.
One thing I would just like to encourage you to put into your addresses is to, you're asking people to take action, and you can give me your feedback on what you think about getting people more involved in electoral politics as action, because there's so many of these chicken lily Congress people, I love that was great, that are running unopposed, even right here next to us in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and it's just astounding to me. So I personally am running for Congress because I have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't let people run unopposed. And as you folks have said, even the Republicans and Democrats, we can't count on. Okay, so I'm running independent. I encourage others here to please do the same. And if you could do that, you have the microphone in this world. You can bring 500 people to run for office somewhere in this country. Give some real opposition. Thank you.
Well, you're exactly right. We all have to step up to the plate. We all have to make some sacrifices and do some things that we never thought we would do. So you may not have ever thought about running for office. And it may seem like a pipe dream. It may be something you don't really want to do. But like the gentleman said, right now we really need to we need to oppose all of these jerks that are in there screwing up our country. So it takes good people to stand up and do it. And please, you know, look in your conscience, talk to your family, your friends, somebody needs to stand up here and do these things, and it could be you. It should be you. If it's not you, it should be the person sitting next to you. So just somebody in your row, in every row right now, let's just find somebody that will volunteer to run for something. I mean, it's as simple as that. And then everybody in this auditorium will work for you. Yeah, it's not that simple. But really, we do need to get a lot more candidates out there.
I think we should quit voting for the lesser of two evils, because you're still going to get an evil person. I think that we're not going to get leaders of conscience until we start voting with our consciences. And the Democrats, I'm a Democrat, I'm a registered Democrat still. I'm a member of the board of the Progressive Democrats of America. You know, I think that in theory our system is good, but in practice it sucks. And right now, to even have a Progressive Democrats of America to me seems just so wrong. I think every Democrat should be progressive and fight for true progressive values. But we know that's not right. You know, I believe that the Democrats can be very good on some issues, like especially social issues. But when it comes to war, they're getting their strings pulled and their pockets lined by the same people that are pulling the strings and lining the pockets of the Republican Party. And except for maybe 70 or 80 members out of a 435-member Congress, they've all been really crappy on the war. Ann and I are using our really good vocabulary today. Jerks, crappy. But I don't really have a lot of faith in electoral politics, even though I'm going to work my tail off for anti-war candidates in the upcoming fall elections. Our electoral system is corrupt. It's broken. And if we don't get paper trails on our voting machines, we might as well not even go vote. And another thing is, the wishy-washy Democrats don't get off their chairs and stand for something, they're going to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory. November is a long time away. How many more people are going to be killed while they're worried about politics? And we have to work every day to fix the system and to bring our troops home. Not count on November, because that's going to be too late for thousands of people in the world.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if you could remind us about comparing the momentum of the anti-Vietnam peace movement and the current peace movement. Is there any way you can remind us of that and compare the two?
Well, I wasn't involved in the Vietnam peace movement because I was in elementary school, but from what I understand from history is that didn't start really until 10,000 soldiers had been killed. Hmm. This peace movement started before the war started. Mm-hmm. And there were thousands of college students out, but there was a draft. There was forced conscription then. And I don't believe that we should have forced conscription. I don't believe that anybody should be used for the war machine. But I believe that we have a large and viable movement, and just because it's not covered by the corporate media doesn't mean it's not happening. Mm-hmm. You know, so and I think it's just a matter of, like I said, like he said, that I said in the introduction, that we have to convince every American that they have a tangible stake in what's going on, just like the immigration movement. Mm-hmm. You know, they were all out because their parents or they were going to get deported if this mess went through. Mm-hmm. So we have to convince everybody that George Bush is damaging every single American. And if they don't get out before we know it, we're going to wake up and we're going to be in concentration camps. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just as simple as that. Mm-hmm. And I want to know why I was just wearing a T-shirt and I got arrested and she was yelling and she just got escorted out. I don't think that's very fair.